We're now beginning the 12th Psalm. The title of this psalm states that it's to the chief musician. And we know that from our previous study of this, that this means that the person in charge of the music for the worship of the Church of Israel, this person was to take this psalm and to direct it, to use it in whatever proper way it could be used for the appropriate worship of the Church of God. So to the chief musician upon Shemaneth, and this word Shemaneth means the eighth or an octave. And it is commonly thought that it means that it was to be sung an octave lower, or maybe the bass voices were to predominate in the singing of it, or it could even be an octave higher than would usually be sung. But it's generally thought to be some kind of a musical term of that nature. And then the title further says that it is a psalm of David, showing us that this psalm, according to the title, was written by David. And we have no reason to think that it wasn't written by David, although there's nothing in the psalm itself that definitely says that David wrote it. On what occasion in David's life this psalm was written, we do not know. There's nothing specific in the psalm that tells us, and there's been several ideas put forth. Some think that it was a result of the persecution by Saul. Some think that it was a result of the rebellion by Absalom, David's son. But we do not know precisely what the circumstances were that caused this psalm to be written, and it really doesn't matter, for there are many things that would apply to the teaching given in this psalm. We do know this, that the psalm undoubtedly does refer to some kind of prevailing iniquity. And as we read in it, it's not hard for us to determine what form of iniquity it refers to. It was a general failure of the faithfulness among good men. A general withdrawal from the active duties of good men, a want of that firmness and zeal which it was proper to expect from those who claimed to be good men. And it particularly refers to the type of speech that these people were using. It was a speech that was not proper, a speech that we should have been able to expect better things of than are given here, a condition in which there was a lack of seriousness, a lack of sincerity in the conversation, in which flattery abounded, and in which the conversation were full of double meanings. Double meanings in which one thing was meant and another thing was actually said. A speech in which the promises that were given so solemnly could not be relied on. And as a result of this type of speech, the poor, the unsuspecting, those who, because of their ignorance, did not have a suspicious nature, they were greatly injured by putting confidence in such persons and in the promises and assurances that these people gave. So it's this state of things that the psalmist is talking about, and he felt that it was proper to call on God to protect those who were exposed to such wrongs as are going to be named in this psalm. We now begin with verse 1 of the 12th psalm. Help, Lord, for the godly man ceaseth, for the faithful fail from among the children of men. So this initial phrase, help, Lord, is calling upon God to give help. There is some kind of a situation existing that requires the help of the mighty Jehovah. It requires his attention. It requires his energy. There is a situation developing, or that's already developed, that is of such a nature that it is going to have some dire and grave consequences. It requires God then to bring about some kind of aid. Man alone doesn't seem to be able to change this, especially the writer of the psalm. Help, Lord. Then he tells what the problem is. For the godly man ceaseth. That is, the man of God. This word for godly really means merciful, and it's just another way of talking about those that are faithful to God. The godly man ceaseth. The word ceaseth means to end or to fail. So this godly man has come to an end. He has failed in some way or another. It could refer to the death of a godly man, but it, as we read the rest of the psalm, we're going to see it's not talking about his death. It's talking about that he has come to an end by failing to be faithful to God. He has stopped being the godly man. He has stopped being the merciful man. He has changed his actions. He's changed his character. He's changed his nature so that he no longer can be qualified as a godly man. He's a different kind of a man now, and consequently, this means that he has ceased or failed or stopped existing on this earth as a righteous person. He is now existing as a different kind of a person. So this happens and can happen any time in the whole history of man. Any time the faithful stop being faithful, any time they start doing things other than what God would have them to do, then they are classified as those that have ceased to exist so far as faithfulness goes. They now are living another kind of existence. He further says in verse 1, "For the faithful fail from among the children of men." That is, those that have professed to have faith, those that have claimed and have been living the right kind of a life, they are no longer here. They are no longer living that kind of a life. They are failing in their duty to God, in their duty that they have professed that they would carry out at a previous time. They're no longer doing that, and so they're no longer found among the children of men. As we examine the children of men, we do not see faithful people there. We see only unfaithful. We see only ungodly, only those that are not merciful, only those that are contrary to the will of God. So you can see then why this general state of affairs would cause the psalmist to be alarmed, why it would cause him to call upon God to give some help. This is a time of crisis. This is a time in which we need some assistance from the divine God above. Verse 2, "They speak vanity, every one with his neighbor. With flattering lips and with a double heart do they speak." Now in this second verse, he's simply showing the characteristics of those that had departed from God, what they had done, how they had changed, so that they now were considered to be unfaithful persons. They speak vanity, every one with his neighbor. This word here for vanity really means falsehood. They were not telling the truth. You could not depend upon what they would say. If they made an agreement, if they made a promise, if they made a vow, you couldn't count on it because you didn't know that they were whether they were going to carry it out or not. Their words were not necessarily what their actions would be. If they told you a story about something, you didn't know if it was a true story or a false story because they could not be relied upon. They speak vanity, everyone with his neighbor. And of course, one of the most common sins among men is the sin of lying, promising to do this and not doing it, or telling a tale about something that's not true at all, out and out lying about something so that you might get off from having to face up to some actions that were not very good actions, promising to pay somebody something when you have no intention of paying. On and on, there are many, many ways that we can lie, but this is the characteristic of those that are not godly men. The godly men are not going to be telling lies. They're not going to be telling falsehoods. You're going to be able to trust their words. When they say something, it's going to be because, to the very best of their ability, it is the truth. It is something they're going to stand behind. It is something that they then are willing to back up and honor. So they speak vanity, everyone with his neighbor. With flattering lips. Now this is another description of the ways that they were speaking this vanity, the ways that they were giving the falsehood. With flattering lips and with a double heart do they speak. This word here for flattering lips really means smooth lips. They were saying things in a flattering way, and of course when you flatter somebody it means that you say things about them that are not true, things that you do not mean, things that you do not believe yourself. But you say it so as to make them feel like that these things are true, as to make them feel like that you're giving them some kind of a compliment, and really you do not intend to compliment them at all. In your own mind, you simply are just trying to deceive them into thinking that you are being complimentary. Flattering lips, saying things to people that make them feel good that you do not mean. You're not genuine at all about saying it. You do not even believe it yourself. And he says, with a double heart do they speak. And this phrase, double heart, really means two hearts or two minds. That is, they had one mind that they were using while they said the things, but they had another mind in which they really believed something different. They didn't really believe what they were saying. They were working as though they had two hearts or two minds. They were acting one way on the surface, and yet they felt and believed quite a different way down beneath the surface. That is, with the other heart. And so this person would be considered to be double-minded. This person would consider to be unstable. He would have to be very treacherous to deal with because he would say one thing and mean another. He would act in one way and when he really believed another way. And so we can see then how that these people were not godly people. They were not considered to be faithful any longer. They had certainly gone aside from the principles of God, and they showed it by the language that they used, by the speech, by the way that they talked, by the way that their words were not really in tune with, in harmony with, their life and their true beliefs. Beginning with verse 3, he shows how the Lord will intervene, how the Lord is not going to let these things go by, but the Lord has a definite feeling about this and consequently will have an action toward it. Verse 3 says, "The Lord shall cut off all flattering lips and the tongue that speaketh proud things." Now this word here for cut off means to disown or to excommunicate. Although these people had been formerly a godly people, they had been those that had been doing the things that God wanted and had been faithful and had been considered to be among those that are God's. Now they're going to be in the position of being cut off. "The Lord shall cut off all flattering lips." Now let's imagine the consequence of this. All flattering lips. Not just a few, not just an occasional one, but all flattering lips. God has such a feeling about them that He wants to cut them off. He will cut them off. He will not tolerate this kind of language, this kind of activity, this kind of behavior on the part of those who claim to be His followers. He should cut off all flattering lips and the tongue that speaketh proud things. Now, the tongue that speaketh proud things is the tongue that had just been doing what we described. This tongue that had falsehood in it. This tongue that had flattery. And this tongue that was boasting. This tongue that was speaking in such a way as to build the speaker up, to make the speaker look good, maybe at someone else's expense, and to continue then be saying things that were not the true, not the genuine thoughts and beliefs and ideas of this person who's doing the speaking. So this is the proud tongue, and God's going to cut this off. And He further describes those who speak this way in verse 4, who have said, "With our tongue will we prevail." With our tongue will we prevail. That is, by our tongue, we're going to get the power. We're going to gain the advantage. We're going to be able to be supreme by the use of our tongue. Now, there are people, of course, who definitely believe this and practice this. They may not actually say this. This doesn't necessarily mean anyone actually has to say this, but they believe it. They practice this. By using the smooth tongue, by using these flattering words, by being able to lie when we have to lie, by being able to boast when we need to boast, by being able to say proud things, then we can prevail. We can talk our way into anything, or we can talk our way out of anything. There are people who definitely practice this. They believe it. They practice it. And they think that it doesn't matter whether it's the truth or not. It doesn't matter whether or not it's something that they really are going to live up to, just so long as they can deceive somebody into believing it long enough to get themselves out of a jam or get themselves into some favorable, advantageous position. It doesn't matter, just so long as they're able to use the tongue in the way that they want to do so. And they think this in their mind. This is their plan of attack. We use the tongue to our advantage. We use the tongue so that we can prevail. And he further gives their thoughts along this line in verse 4. "Our lips are our own. Who is Lord over us?" That is, we can do what we want to with our lips. Our lips are our own. We can use them any way we want to use them. Who's Lord over us? Who's going to make us change? Who's going to make us stop? Who's going to tell us how we can use our lips? And of course, this is a very fallacious way that man begins to exonerate himself from any activities. I can do what I want to with my body. I can say what kind of words I want to say. I can think what kind of thoughts I want to think. I can dress in a way that I want to dress. I can behave in a way that I want to behave. I can abuse my body in a way that I want to abuse it, because it's my body. It's my own. Who is Lord over me? Who's going to change this? And certainly this is true with the use of the lips. There is many a person who would not think of actually cheating someone, or maybe actually physically abusing them by picking up a club and hitting them over the head with it, or stabbing them with a knife, but they wouldn't have any qualms at all about doing a similar thing with words. They can assassinate character. They can say all kinds of bad things, even false things. They can say things in a deceitful, insinuating way, and they can actually lie to this person right to his or her face so that they can get some kind of an advantage, and they have no qualms about it. And so it does seem that this idea of misusing language is one that persons do without any sense of conscience, without any sense of having done something wrong, without any sense of actual sin. But we see here that it is a great sin. This is one of the characteristics of those who have turned against God. This is one of the characteristics of those that God is going to cut off, that God is going to withdraw from. He's going to no longer allow to be in His family. And it's simply a misuse then of the lips, of the words, of the language, of our communicative powers with our fellow human beings. Verse 5, for the oppression of the poor, for the sighing of the needy, now will I arise, saith the Lord. I will set him in safety from him that puffeth at him. So God is going to arise. He is going to come to the aid of those that have his need, who are faithful to him. And he describes it this way. It's for the oppression of the poor. That is, for the wrong done to the poor. And for the sighing of the needy. Because the needy are still among those that are the poor. The needy are sighing, are groaning, are begging for some kind of relief. And God hears this. And because he sees the wrongdoing that's done to them, he sees the oppression of them, he hears the sighing of them, then he says, now will I arise, saith the Lord. He's going to come to their aid, going to come to their protection, going to come to their defense. He says, I will set him in safety from him that puffeth at him. And this seems to mean simply that God is going to set the one who is receiving the bad end of this language, the one that is being oppressed by it, and certainly the needy and the poor, the humble, those that are not suspecting, they're the ones that are affected the most and the worst by this kind of lying, vain speech. The person who is giving the vain speech, he is on the lookout always for somebody to be lying to him, and he's a lot more aware of what may happen. But the one who doesn't talk this way, the one who doesn't think in these terms, he's the first then to be hurt by it, and the one that's going to be hurt the most by it, because he's the least suspecting. He's the most apt to be the victim. So God is going to take the person that's the victim of this kind of language, and he's going to set him in safety. He's going to set him in a condition or position where he will be protected from this kind of activity. And he says, safety from him that puffeth at him. The person who is abusing him, the person who is misusing him, the person who is taking advantage of him, is the one that's puffing at him. And it seems to me that this word puffeth could imply the fact that the language that they use is so vain, it is so false, it is so much of a sham, that is considered to be the same as puffing. Instead of him saying something that's genuine, something that's the truth, something that's going to have some meaning to it, he's saying something that's just vanity, it's a lie, and so he might as well just be puffing at him so far as giving him anything of any value. And certainly our words can be valuable words if we will use them in the right way, if we will speak words of truth and soberness, rather than those things that are flattery, that are vanity, that are actually lies. Otherwise, we're just puffing. And so This act of puffing, then, is what seems to be the description given to the wicked. And God's going to save the ones in safety from that activity. Verse 6, the words of the Lord are pure words, as silver tried in a furnace of earth, purified seven times. This sixth verse contrasts the words of God with the words of these men who are giving the flattering speech. God's words can be trusted. God's words can be depended upon. His words are pure words. That is, they're not fake. They're not false. They're not flattery. They're not vanity. They're not trying to be something that would get the advantage of someone. They're not being given with a double heart. When God says something, he means it, he believes it, and he's going to follow through with it. We can depend upon the words of God. They are pure words. And consequently, when we speak and quote from the words of God, then we are talking the type of language that is absolutely true, pure language. We're talking the language that's in harmony with all of reality. We're not speaking anything that is of a false nature, and we're not speaking anything that's going to mislead someone when we quote from the words of the Lord. His words are pure words. So there's a vast contrast between the words of man and the words of God. And this would tell us very plainly then that anything we do in practice, we must have the words of God to back us up, to be sure then that we're not following after man who might have deceived us. And he further describes these words of the Lord. He says, as silver tried in a furnace of earth. Now, a furnace of earth would be a furnace that had been built in or over the earth, in which the silver has been made to pass through, and as it's heated, the dross comes out of the silver, and only the pure part then is allowed to remain. And so words are so pure, they're like this silver that's been tried in this furnace of earth, or over the earth. This furnace that has been heated so hot that only the pure, genuine silver could be allowed then to stay. And then he says, purified seven times, as though it had been passed through this not just once, but seven times. The word seven here indicating completeness, showing that God's words then are absolutely pure and true. Verse 7, Thou shalt keep them, O Lord, Thou shalt preserve them from this generation forever. This is just simply a statement showing that God is going to be the protector, the preserver of those that have been oppressed. Thou shalt keep them. That is, those who have been injured or harmed by these words of the unfaithful men. Those that have been oppressed in any way, that are the followers of God. Thou shalt keep them, O Lord. Thou shalt preserve them from this generation forever. Now, this generation, then, are the ones that have gone aside, the ones that have failed to keep their faith with God. It seems that all this generation had, in the eyes of the psalmist, had departed from God. And so those that are faithful needed to be preserved from them. And he's simply stating that God's going to do this. Shall keep them from this generation forever. Verse 8, The wicked walk on every side when the vilest men are exalted. Now this eighth and last verse is a difficult verse to explain and understand. But it seems that what he's doing here is simply making a statement about the apparent prosperity of the wicked. The wicked walk on every side, that is, the wicked flourish and abound when the vilest men are exalted. That is, when man upholds or exalts that which is vile, then it lets the wicked abound and walk on every side. The translation, according to the New International Version, renders this verse this way. The wicked freely strut about when what is vile is honored among men. And so it is. When man begins to place his confidence in and give his honor to that which is wicked, then it lets wicked abound more and more. Somebody has to somewhere along the line stand against wickedness. Somebody has to take a stand against these things that are wrong. Otherwise, they're just going to abound more and more and multiply, and then it makes it more difficult for those that are trying to be righteous to be so. So we bring to an end the 12th Psalm. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.